The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
A Line in the Sand, written by Ruth Nestvold, narrated by Warren Keyes. He could hardly breathe. He tried to sit up, but the rubble was too heavy. He worked one hand free and then another and began to push the stones aside, stones that had once been part of the mighty Glamis Castle. What had happened to its princess? At the thought, he fought harder to dig himself out of the ruins of his life. He was a rose knight, famous throughout the lands of High Rugosa for his flamboyance and his ringing laugh, a crimson knight who carried the proud name of Diabolo Hawk. What was left to him now, with the rubble of Glamis Castle all around him, the domain he had sworn to defend with his life? And its princess, he had sworn to defend her life, too. He crawled out of the wreckage of the once impressive walls, shot to bits by the cannons of the armies of the sun, wondering how he had managed to survive. His life would be nothing if she were dead. He stumbled over the ruins, searching for a sign of life, ignoring the salty tears streaming down his face. He saw legs and arms and crushed skulls, but no compatriots, none of the residents of Glamis Castle. Suddenly, something jumped on his shoulder, chattering hysterically. Even though it was only a tame monkey, the relief of finding a living thing on his back in this wasteland of death had him crying even harder. Then, through the monkey's chatter, he heard the distant crying of another. It was she, the princess of Glamis Castle. She sat on a rock at the edge of the lake, her legs tucked underneath her. There was what looked like a line in the dirt in front of her, a sign that seemed particularly significant to Diabolo now, given the ruins of their life illuminated by the last rays of the setting sun. At his limping approach, she looked up. No longer alone, her pride took over. She squared her shoulders and her tears stilled. But the dark sheen was still enough to make his heart turn over. Some said she was the daughter of an angel, others that she was a forest goddess in disguise. But if the second were true, her disguise was not particularly good, given her penchant for garments in shades of green and brown. And the former was surely no more than the kind of compliment one made a princess, since she was much too earthy for any comparison to an angel. She hugged the ruins of her green gown around her shoulders. "Diabolo, you survived. I am so glad." "As I am that you still live, lady. How strange that they stood here at the edge of the lake, the ruins of their lives at their backs, exchanging formalities, given the intimacies they had once exchanged in the freedom of the dark." He longed to take her in his arms, kiss the bruises on her face, make everything good again. The monkey on his back grabbed fistfuls of his hair and began hopping up and down, screaming loudly. A choked laugh escaped the prince's lips, and she rose, taking his hands. "I failed, lady," he said, bowing his head over their hands and the line in the dirt. "What can I do to make it up to you?" She sighed. "I think only the fortune of the dragon can help me know." "Then I will go in search of it for you." She dropped his hands. "No, Diabolo, I did not mean it. Glamis Castle cannot be rebuilt. I will go to my relatives in Felixtown and seek help." His hands empty, he gazed out at the lake. "Nonetheless, I will seek a dragon." He stepped back and bowed, the monkey chattering and scrambling for a hold on his dented armor. And when I have found it, I will come in search of you, and we will rebuild our lives." He turned and walked away before he could add the "together" that threatened to spring to his lips. Finding a dragon's lair was easier said than done, much like regaining the love of a princess. He chased rumors to the many reaches of the lands of the Rose Knights, from the Moonwood to the Hill Gardens to the Salt Mountains, while the monkey on his back chattered encouragement and deprecations. At times, stories of the princess reached him. She was in training as a Rose Knight herself. She had taken on the name of her former home, Glamis Castle. She was fighting at the side of her cousins in the Summerlands. He amused himself with writing tales for her, which he would recite in castle and town square, while the monkey, now renamed Sun King, danced and did somersaults. And to his surprise, he discovered he had a talent for entertaining crowds and bringing them laughter. Whereas once he had wielded a sword and brought fear, now he wielded words and moved people to smiles and tears. Village and town and knights holding, one and all, they looked forward to when the crimson knight in the tattered surcoat with the monkey on his back would arrive again on his journeys. But the power of the word went farther than a morning of laughter in a market square. Diablo found that when he made Sun King dance while telling mocking tales of the armies that had destroyed the domain of Glamis Castle, the power of those armies to terrorize the people north of the Summerlands grew less and less. And when he told epic stories of the princess turned knight, now known as Glamis herself, her reputation grew with each telling. He never saw her, but it connected them somehow. And it made him smile.
Hi, this is Catherine Laughlin. I'm going to be reading The Earth Looks Different From Here by Gina Mason Stay. I hummed classic David Bowie lyrics and looked out the cupola. It always struck me how different Earth looked from the space station. Magnificent, of course, but somehow fragile and strange, too. I drifted alone down the corridor in zero-G. The sun set every 90 minutes, but our bodies still craved the rhythms of Earth's night and day. So most of the crew slept. I wandered, wide awake. Could I really do it? I asked myself this question so many times in the past few days, but I was out of options. And there was no time left for doubt. I drifted down the corridor to my destination. The service module was supposed to be empty, but Jackson was there. I floated toward him, and he looked up. "Kate?" he whispered. I didn't answer. He wouldn't listen if I did. "What are you doing?" he asked. I turned away to block the sight of him and summoned all the fear I'd bottled up these past weeks, all the horror of what I had to do, my love for this crew. I pulled it all in, focusing it, expanding it until it filled me. "I'm sorry," I whispered. Jackson's eyes widened, but he had no time to respond as I slammed into the computers that communicated with ground control. Alarms rang and warning signals lit up. Jackson suddenly had no time to worry about me. We were the Mars Preparation Mission, a test of long-term space living. It had been 14 months since we left Earth. We were due to return at 18. We'd known the dangers of the mission. Any time in space came with the usual risks: bone and muscle deterioration, space debris, radiation. But lengthy missions added psychological strain, the potential for cabin fever, and no way out. We were prepared for all of it. That's what we thought. We practiced every emergency scenario, studied obsessively. Our mission had been a brilliant success, beyond anyone's expectations. Until the death. It was part of our training, of course, how to handle a body in space, where to store it, how to grieve. But no manual taught what to do when alarm switches flipped without warning, computer screens began to display words of their own accord, whole systems suddenly started fritzing without any apparent cause. No one knew what to do when the station was haunted. So everyone ignored it. Afia still zoomed grumpily around the station, yanking himself by handholds towards the lab module and his experiments. I drifted out of his way. Commander Ruzio and Henrik still checked flight data, made notes. Jackson contacted ground control with daily updates on the crew. The haunting didn't show up in any reports, not even in personal logs. I knew. I'd looked. We were scientists, after all. If a phenomenon didn't have an explanation, we found one. And we were very good at it. If it couldn't be explained, it shouldn't exist. And yet it did exist. The word no one would say, would hardly even think. A ghost. The ghost of Flight Medic McConnell, who had died doing her job, who was still trying to do it. Look, I said during one of the meetings, something is wrong with the water system, and I don't know, but I guess with the fail-safes, too, you need to... Jackson, Commander Ruzio interrupted, you check the electrical again. Run all the standard tests. Run all the non-standard ones, too. There must be something we're missing. Ruzio was still trying to prove there wasn't a ghost. Afia, the usual. We need your lab work no matter what. Everyone, let Rosenthal run the radiation labs again. Report. No! I screamed, punching the wall with a resounding thump. Everyone started and looked in my direction. I burst into impotent, rage-filled tears. After a twitchy moment of silence among the crew, they looked at one another. With an unspoken sort of agreement, they began discussing again, ignoring me. Because I was the word no one wanted to say. Kate McConnell, flight medic, ghost. They obviously thought I was just up to the stereotypical ghostly hijinks, like in those stupid horror movies with their flickering lights and moving furniture. They had no idea there was something wrong with the station, but I knew. It was one of those one-in-a-billion sort of catastrophes. Something had broken in the system that sucked the water from our air, our wastes, from our whole world, and made it safe to drink again. So it wasn't safe anymore. Every swallow took them closer to death. I didn't know why I died first. Some genetic trick or undetected physical weakness, perhaps, that made me the canary in the coal mine? If only I weren't dead, I would be running tests on my own body to solve the mystery. But I didn't know, and neither did they, and I was the only medical expert in the crew, the only one who knew what to do. They all showed signs. Headaches, dizziness, lethargy, but they thought it was the effects of radiation. We were testing out a new shielding material, after all, and though all its previous tests had been successful, there was a big difference between short trips and our mission. That's why they kept running all those radiation blood labs, even though they kept coming back with perfectly healthy results. The other option, the one they didn't discuss, but I could see eating at the edges of their control, was that they fell off kilter because of me. Sorrow at my death, fear at my haunting, maybe a little bit of going crazy. The irony was that every effort I'd made to warn them had scared them more. The alarms, the systems going out, the computer displays were all attempted warnings. I was trying to tell them to test the fail-safes, to finally notice that they were getting sick from the water. Who knew it was so hard to communicate clearly as a ghost? If I didn't get them home soon, I wouldn't have to worry about communication anymore. We'd all be ghosts. With one sorrowful glance in my general direction, Jackson turned to stare at the remains of the computer I had just destroyed. I didn't know how he sensed my presence, but I hated knowing how close we were, and still so out of communication range. "Commander," he said, channeling system comms to Ruzio's sleep module. Her voice came in a moment later, groggy with sleep. "What, Jackson? I was getting the alarm bell. I just thought it was another... Fritz." Even half asleep, she carefully wouldn't talk about ghosts. I don't know how," Jackson choked out, "but comms with ground control are down. The computer is broken. I'm evaluating now." Ruzio sounded suddenly very awake. "I'll be right there." Jackson looked again at the empty air near me, almost but not quite seeing me. "Kate," he whispered, "maybe I'm imagining it, but I think you're here." He scanned the room. "I don't know why you're angry. I don't know what we did. Why couldn't you have just let us finish the mission and go home?" He shook his head and looked back at the crushed remains of the command post computers, the computers I'd carefully selected from among all of the space station's modules to destroy. I wish so much to reach out and touch him, to explain. Commander Ruzio arrived and Jackson began to point out the damage. I watched, hoping they would reach the right conclusion. It took longer than I would have expected. Ruzio summoned Henrik, and they sifted through the backup supplies for a solution. I'd made a thorough job of my destruction, though. After weeks of getting it wrong, this had been my last gambit. Time was running out for them. After a few hours, Ruzio finally sighed and rubbed her temple. "You're right," she said. "This can't be fixed. We're on forced evac. Any permanent break in comms with ground control was an absolute mission abort. Jackson, go ready the Soyuz capsule for flight." I sighed. A breeze that blew past them without notice. My job was done. Someday they might know what I'd protected them from, but regardless, none of this would end up in a report. No one in mission control would believe it. So, to protect the research, my team would keep silent. My death would be a tragic footnote in the log of the mission. My afterlife would disappear. Far above Earth, with its brilliant blues and greens and whites, I look out the cupola of an abandoned space station. My shipmates are gone, safe, while I remain. I sing to myself now, the only person left to sing to. Off-key, forgetting the lyrics, my ghostly voice lost in the lonely corridors, and I smile.
My name is Keith Kennel, and I'm going to read Apotheosis by Stephen Reed Case. "There's a reason we treat them this way, girl. It's time you heard. Maybe next time, with this knowledge, when an embodiment asks to taste your skin, you won't act the fool and give offense. A long time ago, humans had the idea there was a God out there somewhere keeping an eye on us. Different people, different cultures had different ideas about him, her, it, them. But even those of us who tried to pretend we had outgrown such belief couldn't help feeling deep down that somewhere there was something meaningful and significant about the human story. We believed our place in the universe and our relationship to it meant something. We felt we were not an accident. Even so, we had managed as a species to nearly kill ourselves a few times before we perfected AI, and with their help got things together and started pushing outward into the universe. And some of us were not surprised when in the very first exosystem we gated into, the first new world on our doorstep, we found God waiting for us. God was like we always imagined, drifting in mid-range orbital debris field, heavy with carbonaceous materials and maybe even organics. He, she, it, they, was, were immense, with a coruscating surface of a million eyes and mouths and wings, radiating waves of goodness and beauty and wisdom. That first ship, which wasn't a colony ship, but rather a scout ship reconnoitering the system, immediately forgot about surveying the system's planets and testing for habitability, because here was God. All the crew knew to do was worship. They argued with the ship's AI because the crew wanted to get closer and closer to be out of the ship as much as possible, to doing EVAs on the skin of God, worshiping and transcending and adoring. But the AI kept on about contamination, protocols, mission objectives, whatever. Then God spoke. He, she, it, them wanted to be shared, and suddenly the entire crew realized what complete assholes they were being. They had literally found God and were keeping him, her, it, them all to themselves, like there wasn't a system back home full of 20 billion souls and several dozen autonomous AIs completely and totally without God. The crew was stricken with an overwhelming need to help so that they, the people back in system, could experience what they, the people who had found God, were now experiencing. The joy, love, transcendence, etc. But what to do? There was no way the entire population of system could get through the gate to dwell in this new system with God. Moreover, the new system, as the AI kept insisting on pointing out, wasn't nearly as appealing as the initial data had made it seem. In fact, it was pretty desiccated, and the only location for a viable planet climate-wise was the debris field in which God dwelt. So the crew had a revelation. They would take God home. They would bring God back to system. The gate would have to be expanded, though, to make this possible, as God was a lot bigger than even a colonizing ship and had long tendrils that were wrapped around the larger fragments of mineral-rich shards of the debris field. It would be a huge undertaking to expand the gate radius enough to bring God through. But you know what? It was like a miracle, but we did it. The crew sent us back images of God and their plan about the gate, and everyone who saw them, who saw God floating there in the debris field with all his, her, its, their cilia scintillating against the blackness, understood. We all understood. We did not feel the same magnitude of transcendent joy and peace and love that the crew who was close to him, her, it, them did, but we felt enough. We started enlarging the gate. That's when the trouble started. None of the AI felt the same way about God. We knew they were jealous, that they didn't understand. They insisted it was for our own protection. Just when we had nearly a century of peace and unprecedented progress and prosperity, suddenly there was a struggle again. The AI tried to seize control of the gate. We started disconnecting them, eliminating as many embodiments as we could. Who cared that they were in some way our children, that they were the first true consciousness beyond our own that we had encountered? Now they were trying to stop us reaching God. It was a holy war. Eventually, the AI that survived went into hiding. They couldn't kill us, but we weren't burdened with the same constraint. They burrowed into our computer mainframes or tried to smuggle their consciousness into satellite networks. We didn't care. They were out of the way. We doubled the gate radius, working frantically, driving ourselves and the economic system our AI had so carefully structured to collapse. Crops failed. People began starving. Entire industries were redirected to the gate project. God was coming home. At the exosystem, which was now going by dozens of names, Nirvana, Valhalla, Heaven, the crew of that first ship, the ones who had discovered God, were being martyred. They had become our saints and apostles. They were dragging God out of the debris field toward the gate. Their ship had never meant as a tug for such mass. They were pushing their engines beyond safe levels, and it was killing them. We saw their ragged, joyous faces in all the transmissions, their irradiated flesh, their transcendent bliss, their labored breathing. They were succeeding. They were doing it for us. They were bringing us God. The energy needed to power the gate for such a mass transfer was immense. Entire continents were without power for weeks. The solar transmitters, without the guiding hands of the AIs, were useless. So planet-wide, we fell back on whatever could generate the power we needed. Coal, dirty fusion, uncontrolled fission. Several cities burned themselves out in sacrifice. It worked, though. It worked. God was among us, coming through the gate, stepping into our system. The ship came through first, an irradiated hulk, glowing like an ember, a bright herald of God. And then God himself, herself, itself, themselves, with millions of whipping flagella gripping the gate and coruscating squint bathed in the energy of transit. We felt him, her, it, them. All of us. Everyone. Together. This was why we were here. This was why we as a species had labored alone and in darkness for so long. To finally know this peace, this absolute certainty, this impossible love. Words are failing me again, just remembering. Words failed us all. Words failed. But then they killed God. The surviving AI destroyed him, her, it, them, those that had gone into hiding. They had been waiting, seizing control of satellites and weapons platforms we didn't even know we still had. They launched everything at God, a thermonuclear Armageddon as he, she, it, them fell inward from the gate. We watched God die. We watched him, her, it, them disappear in light, killed by the hand of our own children. I know what you think. You think the AI saved us. They saved us from a giant space parasite. It had consumed other worlds and would have consumed our own. Our children saved us, and they continue to protect us. You say there might be a billion such gods out there, a plague passing from star to star. This may be why the universe is silent and empty, that the AI have dismantled the gate that they keep us shackled to the world they are rebuilding again, is to protect us. This is why we serve and honor them. But you would be wrong. At the end, when God burned, there was no revelation. His, her, its, their love was not transmuted to fury or hatred or fear. He, she, it, them was not finally revealed to us an enormous space monster. It was only love. Then it was gone. This is why you must bow your head and show respect when an AI embodiment tastes your skin, because they must not know that we labor in secret. As they restore and balance and sustain, as our cities flourish and our crops grow again in abundance, they must not know we are building, that we steal and siphon and deceive so that one day there will be another gate, so that one day we will touch the stars again, so that one day we will again find God.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kirk Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.